welcome to The Logstat, the Army's premier podcast on all things sustainment, where we analyze new developments, discuss current trends, and forge the path ahead for the next generation of sustainment soldiers. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of The Logstat. I'm your host, Captain Garrett Powell. Before we begin today's discussion, I wanted to remind the audience that the submissions for the fall edition of the Army Sustainment Professional Bulletin are due on July 15, 2025. The theme is Building and Sustaining Combat Readiness in Large-Scale Combat Operations. Now, if you have a great article that doesn't directly match the theme, that is perfectly fine. Still submit it. We want to get your information out to the community. If you have an idea for an article and don't know where to start writing or need assistance refining your article, then please reach out to me. As your Sustainment Center of Excellence Harding Fellow, I'm here to help you through the writing process. For future reference, our upcoming themes are as follows. The winter 2026 is going to be Data-Centric Command and Control, Transforming and Converging Sustainment Warfighting Systems with C2 Next. Those articles will be due October 15, 2025. Tentatively, the Spring 26 edition will be focused on Army Maintenance Modernization, Predictive Maintenance, the Future of OIB, Forward Repair, and Telemaintenance Operations, with articles due the 15th of January, 2026. And lastly, Summer of 2026, with a focus on Strengthening Sustainment Warfighting Profession. Those would be due 15 April of 2026. This has been a month of historical celebrations for the Army, with all the 250-year birthdays. Last week, we had a great conversation with Mr. Timothy Gilhol on the 250 years of the Quartermaster Corps. If you haven't listened to it yet, I highly suggest you go and check it out. He has a wealth of knowledge, and we barely scratched the surface on everything Quartermaster. Now, today, we're going to take it a step further and focus on the 250 years of sustainment from beans to bullets with another great historian filled with knowledge, Mr. Carl Rubis. Mr. Rubis is one of the command historians here at the U.S. Army Combined Support Command, CASCOM, in Fort Gregg Adams, Virginia. He holds a Master's of Arts degree in American History and Military History from the University of Kansas and a Bachelor of Arts degree in History from Pepperdine University. He also has a certificate in International Relations from Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. He has published articles and book reviews in the Journal of Military History, Army Sustainment Professional Bulletin, the Ordnance Magazine, and various other volumes focusing on military history and the history of military logistics. He has taught courses at the University of Kansas, UCLA, and Pepperdine University. In 2016, he retired from the U.S. Navy as a Naval Intelligence Officer and as a graduate of the Naval War College. I'm so happy to have you on the show today, sir. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Captain Pyle. I do appreciate the chance to be on here today, and I hope that our listeners find a lot of value in what we talk about today.
Exactly. And of course, first, be the first one we'll accept you here, and that'll be in Navy, come out here in the Army.
I always get a lot of ribbon on that one, but it's all good nature around here.
So just kind of first, what was your naval service like?
Oh, I spent 20 years active and reserve. First 7 years were active. I joined in 1996 and as an intel officer. And of all the funny things, I wanted to join because I wanted to see the world. And little did I know that paid in dividends because very quickly within the first couple of years, I went to, I was in Bosnia in 97. I got Kosovo in 99. And then wrote my second assignment, and then, of course, 9/11. And then right after I went to the reserves, I quickly got mobilized again. I spent a year in Iraq. So all those things put together, I did see a lot. So I had traveled a lot too. So, but I really enjoyed the naval service. Primarily, finally focusing on strategic intelligence, a little bit on tactical, a little bit on battle damage assessment. Some of those main areas in naval intelligence, yeah.
Awesome.
So, yeah, I always have good sea stories when I've talked to my classes about bulkheads and all sorts of things and mess halls and things like that to keep it interesting.
So we're coming at it today from, you got a wealth of, I mean, from just everything I just read off just now, from all your degrees and all the studies you've done, as well as your military experience, being able to travel the world with the Navy. So it's going to be great to have your insight today on just sustainment overall.
Well, thank you.
250 years, it's amazing. First of all, it's been 250 years. Mm-hmm. You know, last week we talked specifically on the Quartermaster, but now we're kind of looking at it all of sustainment, because even though the cost of what we look at sustainment now, like, you know, logistics, of course, is a newer branch, but the concept of what the foundation has been here since the beginning.
Absolutely. Absolutely right, Captain Pyle. It's funny. One of the things I like to say to everybody in classes and people in the ordnance training support facility, whatever the case may be, is that, you know, a lot of Army sustainment history, also Army logistics history, looking at the two together, it's a lot of American history. It really connects with the two going back to the very beginning. Immediately talking with, the establishment of the New Republic. You know, I mean, you can talk about Valley Forge and all the efforts that we do there. And up at War College is actually called the Hessian Powder Magazine. Actually, it's a munitions facility, and it's on the grounds. You go visit it today. Ever since that very beginning, you know, sustainment has been doing a lot of work. Logistics, I'll use the two words back and forth. But, like, you know, building the first weapons, you know, the Ordnance Branch running the armories of Springfield and Harper's Ferry. 1795, building those weapons, artillery pieces. I mean, that type of participation has always been there. You have, today we call it the organic industrial base, the official term, but that side of it, you know, what are you doing? Who's building what? Building the services. And not, again, not just for soldiers, but for, you know, your recruits, you know, the volunteers in the Civil War, the volunteers in the Mexican War, whatever the case may be. And also the front lines, how do you support that? What are you doing? They got a huge boost in World War One, of course, with the adaption of modern mechanized warfare, creating of units. And, you know, Ordnance Branch called the mobile ordnance repair shops. That's a contact truck. You know, how do you do the basic tenet of some of the sustainment support as close to the front line as possible? That comes out of World War One, and there's lots of examples. It gets codified in war years, and by World War Two, you know, we got units all over the place. You can look it up online. You can find, you know, the quartermaster companies or the truck companies at that time being established in 42, or the ordnance companies or brigades or battalions, just thousands of units of them. That is the whole, I mean, in a nexus, that's the support that we've given to the U.S. Army ever since the very beginning, and continue to in so many ways. That's a major, major part of it. So that'd be, if I summed it up in any way, I'd sum it up like that. It's really, it's a multi-tiered effort, if you want to think of it that way, just kind of coming at it and supporting as best we can. So, yeah.
Yeah, good. Yeah, and that's the kind of what we're kind of be, you know, going over today is like the impacts, like what sustainment's look like from the beginning, like where it's at now, like especially and where is it going to get us in the future? Because you have everything you've studied, you get to have that insight of everything that's happened, which is going to lay the foundation of where we're going.
Right.
So kind of like, and you just kind of hinted to on a lot of what you're just discussing, but there's some more on some of the highlights of sustainment throughout the Army's history.
There's some great ones. One of my favorites is here's a note I usually give to all my classes. I was saying, listen, you know, I came here as the Ordnance Branch historian back in 2011, and did the REAM organization. Now, Mr. Gilville and I, we work up at the CASCOM echelon level, but doing the classes. And everybody was like, oh, where do you go? I said, listen, if you want to go to the best museum to study the very first weapons, you want to study the first Springfield serial number ones, go to Springfield Armory. Today it's a National Historic Site. But it was the functioning principal logistics organic industrial base, to use the term, from the very beginning, 1795. George Washington picked it out. He says, you're going to take the most cutting-edge technology, and that's what it was at the time, to build these weapons. And so you can go there today and you can see them on the wall and get examples of it. That's a great unit. That used to be before you're a chief warden, and that was like the number two spot. You're there, and then you go become chief wardens for how many years? Of course, that goes away in 73, changed to private contractors, a whole other story. So you can find units like that. That's one of my favorite ones. I'm a big believer in museums, so I think they can tell a lot of that stuff, especially when you understand when you're going into it, and the curators do a great job. But again, I think one of the fundamental changes for the U.S. Army, as far as units, and I kind of made reference to it before, is World War One, because that's really the beginning point of modern mechanized warfare. You've got to create these units. This is when the branches, by the way, go from the smallest branches in the Army to the biggest. The size of the Ordnance Branch, the Quartermaster Branch, the TC, we're the biggest branches now for a reason, because with mechanized warfare, you got to have somebody repairing stuff. So you got these mobile ordnance repair shops. These units are fascinating. If you look at them, it's a funny name. It kind of sounds like an old-timey name type of thing. But if you look at the Tillers organization, you see these. Every division had one. The third division was called the third MOR, third Moors. And I got some of the records up in the office. And no kidding, when they deployed on the front in 1917, they set up maintenance shops as close to the front line as they could, you know, like an FSB or whatever. And indeed, some of those units were coming under fire, artillery fire from the Germans. So they had to pull their entire unit back. But guess what? They left a forward element forward to do some even lighter repairs. And you say this, I'm like, oh, God, that sounds familiar. Like, exactly. That's where it comes from. So that's one great unit. I like talking about those. You know, he's got these embryonic units, which are fascinating. Other units I think of, good grief. I mean, if you look at it, you can find something. We just had the D-Day commemorations here, of course, a couple of days ago. You can find, like, the 16th Bomb Disposal Squad. They're out there on the beaches at D-Day plus two, landing on Omaha Beach. And they go out there, and it's funny because, you know, most of the records, they wrote some records down. It's like, first thing we did was set up, you know, salvage, repair. What can we do to help out? Usually a recovery for soldiers, but soon they set up their ammunition depots. All those landings, we always see, you know, Banner Brothers, but also it's the 407th Quartermaster Company of the East Lincoln Airborne Division. They're glidering, you know, into it. It's not just airborne paratroopers, but also the QM companies, the OD companies coming in on those units doing all that work. And so, I mean, you can pick up so many units. To agree, I could give you a couple. TC's got the gun trucks. It's so funny because for a long time, gun trucks were like, it was kind of this exotic thing from Vietnam. You have a take gun, you upper armor it, you put some machine guns on it. In Vietnam, it sounded great. And we have, you know, TC branches, two of the Medals of Honor are gun truck drivers. And then all of a sudden you get to Iraq, and all of a sudden everybody's like, hey, how did we do this before? And you start pulling out those units again. And he started, hey, how do we up armor the van? How do we start doing these things? And the TC Museum has an exhibit on that. And they worked on that a lot. So, I mean, I could go on and on about different units all day, many a long time.
I remember just learning a little thing about those gun trucks. I went through at the time that transportation bullock.
Yeah.
Went over there seeing them in the museum.
Mm-hmm.
Off the top of my head, I can't remember the names of those trucks they have in the museum right now.
Right.
Those from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Just the unique way that they utilize those over there.
And that you pointed that out, because many times, you know, on one hand, you've got, this is our systemic solution to all this, but many times it's you have a unit, and what are you going to have in a unit? You're going to have a couple senior sergeants, NCOs in there, maybe a warrant, and these guys had the problem, they solved it. They said, how am I going to do this? Well, hey, let's put some stuff on. Get the welder over here from OD. And it's all done. It's all low rank, and it's not the officers involved. Usually a company can't say, hey, go do it. Or plainly say, that's fine with me, you know. But the soldiers figured it out. You know, if you go to the Ordnance Training Support Facility, you've got the hedgerow cutters, Cullen hedgerow cutters. You know, the breakout in Normandy, they had to figure this out. So one of the staff sergeants said, hey, why don't you weld on the front of a vehicle these kind of prongs? It kind of looks like, bottom line, it looks like electric hair cutter clippers, okay? And you do it inside of a V-section. And he said, hey, let's try it. So it's a bunch of NCOs that got that together. And they showed it to the officers. They said, oh, that might work. Because they're trying to figure out how do you break out. We're stuck. You know, men are dying. And so they showed it to the officers. And Bradley loved this so much. He says he wants, and he just came down, I want every vehicle on the Western Front, every, you know, truck, tank, light tank, tank destroyer, whatever the case may be, weld them on. That was an NCO came up with that. You know, so, and you want a big... And the funny thing about that is after that, then of course, he got rotated home to go on a big war bonds tour and got out of fighting because he figured it out. So, yeah, figure out something great. You may get a chance to go home. That's the story. So, there's so many great units there.
No, it's just amazing to see the impacts of sustainment throughout history.
Oh, it is, yeah.
I mean, I think it's neat that you brought up and highlighted, like, being the largest branches now.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much we have to do as sustainers to enable the maneuver fight.
Right.
Right.
And again, and you can look at that so many ways. And petroleum came to the QM world in World War One, and so now how do you work petroleum? And the Army's working hard on that solution. How do you get that petroleum out there? Now, does Iraq give us a good idea? You know, well, yeah, sort of. But now you're into Ukraine. Now you're looking at these other things. How are you going to move? especially with, you have drones out there. You know, how do you support and maintain drones? Everybody's figuring that out now. And that's something you have to really kind of deal with, I mean, in all this. And that's on that, that sustainment side, on the front side. And you got AMC, too, trying to figure this stuff out. So how's AMC going to be connected to all this? I mean, that was the AMC command. You can't, don't forget, AMC command was established out. It was blood, basically, taken out of OD and TC and QM and some of the other technical branches to say, you're in charge of the whole backside, research, development, train, experiment, et cetera, propagate, whatnot, and ship. That's what your job is. They've been doing it since 1962. So that's when that came out of each of the branches had that responsibility until then. So, you know, their four-star general tends to be a sustainer in one way, shape, or form. So, yeah, it may not get a lot of the frontline press, but let me tell you, it's there all the time. And basically, it will enable it, or you can lose if you don't have it. Bottom line. So that's the part we enjoy teaching to the students. And so, yeah, it's very multifaceted. Yeah.
So what would you say then is some of the major impacts that sustainment has had on the Army as a whole?
The major impacts, it's fun because you look at that, you think of it, if you have a maneuver-based Army, what have we done to enable a maneuver-based Army? And those are the impacts they come to. I mean, you look at efficient operations, you look at improving fuel supplies, you look at maintenance. Everybody's favorite, everybody learned how to take apart their rifle, clean it, put it back together, preventive, you know, maintenance and check systems, PMCS. That's out of the ordnance branch, World War II. They came up with that idea to fix everything. Now, every soldier does their own primary maintenance on their individual weapon, whatever the case may be, but all that system that OD just lives on comes out of the ability to maintain readiness rates. I mean, that was one of the achievements of World War II, is we could keep our vehicles in the field at about an 80-90% operational readiness rates, and the Germans can only master 50%. And so even though we may not have the best equipment, you know, M4 never wins the, you know, Battle of Tanks, best tank in World War II series, but let me tell you, it was always in the fight. It was always returned back out there. That's what you can do for the Army, is keeping the forces out there, supplying the necessary force you've got to give, whether it be, you know, fuel, whether it be food, whether it be moving the troops, all that type of stuff. And that's what sustainment enables. Because it's I tell the classes this, and I come back to it. The American Army, what type of army is the American Army? You know, is the whole field of studies is the nature of the German Army, the nature of the U.S. Army, or the American Army, or the U.S. forces in general. You know, the American Army is an expeditionary army. It means we always go somewhere to fight there. We don't do it here. So you have to have an army to do that. You got to be able to move them. You got to be able to supply them. You got to be able to fuel them. And be able to recover them. That's the expeditionary army. And we do it better than anybody else in the world. Bottom line. That's why so many operations want U.S. support, because we can move this stuff. Now, we want everybody else to be as to contribute and be a part of it, of course. But that's the force multiplier. But when it's moving things there, it often comes to the U.S. Army to do it. Other countries do it well, but overseas, such rapidity, it's the American Army they have to look at. And the Navy and all the other forces. So there's my Navy puck.
The Navy. You know, I got me coming from transportation. And we're moving everything by seas.
Absolutely.
So that's why I got throw it in, because we're moving the Army's equipment across. And that's what I love about the transportation. Like, you know, you got the air, sea, rail.
Exactly.
Land transportation. So like you said, we're moving everything.
And those are some of the principles that we have come back to, is because enduring principles, when you look at it, it's not necessarily something you learn once, you never do it again. Tim and I will take people out on the staff ride. We go to Petersburg. We talk about, you know, the Overland Campaign, 1864. How did the Union Army move down here so fast? And they say, oh, what's the best way to move an army? It was water. It's been true 150 years ago. It's as true today. Easiest, best way to move it. Now, how well can we do it? Have we had that ability and lost it sometimes? Well, the Army's working really hard right now, working Operation Pathways and Operation. We can move more things by water than you ever can. Airplanes look cool on a TV when you can deliver it fast. and they can be a good initial force to set up a blocking, but can massive amounts of armor and vehicles and all of that. You know, all the troops went to Vietnam, they didn't fly there, they went by boat, and they came home by boat.
Yeah.
Now, when you have a long-term thing like an Iraq or Afghanistan, yeah, air can take it over because your troops are there, and so then you can continue, you know, taking them out, putting them in, air will probably work. But, you know, it was the 7th Corps in Desert Storm. All their vehicles were taken down there by boat around from Europe. So those enduring principles, I think, is the value, especially the TC, Transportation Corps. I think the Army's working really hard to embrace that again.
That's why we are the spirit of logistics.
There you are. It's right. Exactly. So it's a lot of that. And so
that's awesome just to be able to see these impacts the sustainment community has had.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just, you know, one branch or another.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, being sustainment, we still have the contributions from the finance
yes.
side of the house.
Or, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. The AG side of the house. Mm-hmm. It all falls under that umbrella.
Right, right. AG's got a special machine. I know, it's funny. Up here at Fort Gregg Adams, you know, we talk about, you know, of course, the three branches are here, QM, TC, and Ordnance. But you're absolutely right. AG, I mean, they're working down at Fort Jackson with the replenishment operations, as in, you know, you think large scale. Here's the other thing I like to talk about too, and tell students, you know, every major large scale combat operation that the United States has had in history, Civil War, World War I, World War II, Vietnam, all the big ones, a lot of the force was resupplied and brought in were not necessarily full time soldiers or even National Guard. You know, how does AG gonna work that? They gotta work a problem too. That's a very big problem, you know, as that side. We are not going to be able to stay the same size we are for next large-scale combat. It's not going to work. And this is nothing a radical thought. People are saying, how are we going to do this? That was one of the things with, I was reserve at the time going to Iraq. And there were Army National Guard units, reserve units that have been over there 3, 4, 5, 6 times. You know, how can you do that in the next, in the future situation? So, AG's working that problem right now. So, yeah, they're very much in the fight. Absolutely. Yeah. So, I'm going to give some due attention to them as well. So
then in your opinion, of course, this is your opinion from being a historian and
mm-hmm.
had a chance to review a lot of battles and historical engagements
mm-hmm.
for the Army, specifically the sustainment world. What would you say, in your opinion, is the most heroic story from a sustainment unit, or was this a heroic unit?
That's a hard question.
I'm already here to give you the hard ones.
That's great. No, it's good. Hard questions are good. It makes you think. That's the value of it. It's hard because in what Tim and I do, we always look at so much of a breadth and you see so many contributions made by so many units. And I'm not trying to evade the answer.
There's no right or wrong.
That's a difficult one. Wow. One that comes up in the Red Ball Express, we've all heard about Red Ball Express. You went there. Red Ball Express, for those, just for everybody's benefit, Red Ball Express was a special transportation mission put together by several units and volunteers too, to move supplies to the forward line of the American troops under Patton primarily. He was pushing so far so fast that they took the entire CONOP for support to the Army and went out the window. When he broke out into the northern France, he surged across northern France eastward toward the German border. And so the Red Ball Express, basically they put together these ad hoc units. So it borrowed from many different units. To deliver the class 1 and the class 3 and the class 5 to them as fast as possible. And so that was a big sin. That's a very storied unit. And there's just so many great stories about that. Driving 24 hours, they had two drivers. One would fall asleep, so they had to stop and put the other one in there. And they literally, it was an ordnance mechanic's nightmare because they literally drove these trucks into the ground over unimproved roads to get the material there in time. To continue to fight. So it's just a great epic of doing that support to the front line. A lot of lessons about convoy operations. Of course, Red Ball Express was the first one. And indeed, there's actually there's a Green Ball Express and a Rainbow Express and a White Express that came in future in late 44, early 45 to other areas. And they learned how to do convoy operations very efficiently. So it would heavily influence the whole convoy doctrine for the future there. Units, again, going back to units, that's hard. I can think of efforts that we made, really good efforts. Berlin Airlift. I mean, and to be important to remember, it's not just being the Army. I can think this way, I'm subject to it. It's not just about breaking things, you know. Berlin Airlift, huge, you know, keeping the city alive for a year. You know, a lot of sustainer units were involved in that. Yeah, the Army, Air Corps, and the Air Force were flying it, but operating all the material and all the food, and literally they lived by that airlift for a year. It's a pretty remarkable thing. And if you ever traveled to Germany, now they're probably much older. They're kids probably if they're alive, and they say, yeah, they remember that as a kid. It's a very significant point. And there's other elements too. There's a little known one called Operation Chowhound. Basically, the Netherlands, at the end of the war, they were about to starve. There was widespread famine there due to war and a whole bunch of other reasons. Blockades, the Nazi, you know, German food, shipments and where they're going to, whatnot. We basically fed the country for several weeks and saved them from, and there's monuments there. If you ever go there, like, oh yeah, they recognize that. So those are some of the great efforts we made as well.
That was the first I heard of that one.
Really? Yeah. It's, you don't hear too much on that one. But yeah, just huge efforts because that's what we can do. And I think in some of the excerpts from the flyers that were, and these are B-17s, B-24s, all the basic things, flying stuff in. Actually, of all the things, we made agreements with the Germans not to fire on us so we could deliver it because they couldn't sustain them. So it's a fascinating story. But the bombers, they said this is some of the most satisfying missions they ever had because, you know, spent so many years, you know, in a very lethal combat over Germany. Also, now I'm going to supply people, keep them alive. Like this, they really umped their morale a lot. So it's very interesting. It's a great story. Operation Chowhound. So yeah, I mean, wow. There's many good ones here. I could go on. I could go on. I mentioned a few of the units already. And the thing is, more of those stories are going to come out. It's going to happen. And that's a great part about it, you know. The truth of the matter is you're an Army career or a Navy career, it goes in a blink of an eye. And, man, I remember being, I was a lieutenant going, oh, man, I'm year 7, 20, oh, my gosh. And all of a sudden, here I am. I was looking at 2 years to go. I'm like, hey, what just happened? And so, and you can never believe and guess what you'd be doing. So, yeah. Yeah, more and more great stories are coming about units. I think of any more, I'll try to eject them. But
I just, because I know there's just so many, as you said, out there,
mm-hmm.
Different stories of sustainment units that have done so many different things.
Right. I mean, one of the big ones, I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt you here. I mean, I came out, I'd forever be mad at myself. I didn't mention, you know, the movie that came out on Netflix about Charity Adams, that just hit. A lot of pressure on that on the 6AAA. That's a great story. And the thing is, there are many out there. I mean, because that's what those units do. They don't, and they do that support. So, sorry, go ahead.
No. I was saying that I could be wrong. I don't know if this is a full sustainment unit, but during here in the Battle of Petersburg, when they were digging the tunnels to dig the tunnels across into the Confederate lines.
Right.
Was that a sustain? I don't know. I don't know if that was part of
sustainment. It's part of sustainment unit. Yeah, they're getting a lot of support. And then it goes back to what I was mentioning. You know, those are all volunteers. Those are citizen soldiers. As most, you know, if you ever see the gravestone in Arlington, they always say, you see, joiners of private brevet colonel. Like, how are these people doing that? Well, they're citizen soldiers and they're elected by their militia to be a colonel. That's the way it operated back then. And so it's pretty sustainable. But supporting that was a City Point operation. I'd be really, my Petersburg Battlefield friends would never let me live it down. But, you know, today it's Hopewell. That's the name of the city. But City Point was the biggest sustainment operation on the East Coast. You know, it was the busiest port facility on the East Coast. So, you know, 20 ships a day. Yeah, not much there today. But what it was done, it was mastered. And it wasn't just that city. The entire region, you had ordnance facilities across over there. Across the other side of the Appomattox and down the river, you had cattle pens for all the food and just all over the place. It's a huge operation. And they're doing that. And the thing is, they're doing this and they knew exactly how much was on every boat and did a pencil and paper. And they coordinated every single day. Yeah, without all the computer systems, it can be done. It takes a little effort, but it has been done. And it will be done. So, yeah.
They never lose the art of analog.
No. Because it's all about thinking. That's the whole schooling, thinking about this stuff. Computers help you. And they give you a great service, but you still need to have the ability to think, what do I need? Ask the questions, think through the process. And that's what the TAC Bullocks over there, Captain Scorch and, you know, and Bullock work on.
Yeah. So, yeah. But I definitely think that's a, and for all of yours out there, if you have a chance, come down and, you know, see City Point, see the Petersburg here, because it's an amazing, you just allude to the sustainment operations that were conducted here.
Mm-hmm.
And how I said, being the largest port on the East Coast is still hard to believe in today's world, but just the massive amount of supplies that poured into there. As you said, they did it by pencil and paper.
Yeah.
And how they're able to supply the Union Army here as being one of the last big battles of the Civil War.
Right. Right. And it's funny because it was a sustainment fight. I mean, and the importance of that, I mean, we'll see that. And I think a lot of the commanders see that in the field and they understand that. It's because Petersburg was a transportation hub, and that's why they wanted it. That's what Grant knew. And if I get that, Richmond can't, is not sustainable. And matter of fact, after it fell, day later, it evacuated Richmond. And then the army finally caught up to them, building railroad tracks along the way, literally. As, you know, they weren't all up to Appomattox. They were about halfway behind. But people were doing that. Yeah, good stuff.
So I'll kind of like going back to, you know, you are a historian. Mm-hmm. And one thing I asked last week, and I always want to be able to ask again here, is that, you know, it can be difficult to predict the future, of course, but I look at it as the seeds of our future can be found in our past. So what lessons learned from the past can impact the future of sustainment operations, in your opinion?
I think one of the big value points of looking at the history of sustainment can appreciating the fact that where they were when it started, World War One, World War Two, whatever the case is, what they looked at, they didn't have it all set up when the first day of fighting started. It evolved and it changed. And it's always going to change. It adapted. Things did not work, try something else. And sometimes you'll hear, they weren't ready for it, but this time we've been thinking about it a lot, we're ready for it. We can always knock that down, because no matter how you are, in contact changes everything. The opponent has a voice in the whole equation, and it introduces variables. So all of a sudden, what we thought would work doesn't. No matter how much we rehearsed it, it looked good there, but guess what? It just doesn't match. And the thing is also where, you know, we talk about Europe, and I think the Army sometimes has a little bit of a Europe bias because the accomplishments in Europe, which were great, and for historical reasons that, you know, Pacific, you don't hear much about it. You think the Marines won the war. Well, there are 26 divisions in the Pacific, Army divisions, over 5 Marine Corps. So, and look at the fighting in the Philippines and all the sustainment for there. There's a lot you can learn from that. And you'll see that even with plans thought out in advance, more adaptation had to be done. And also a theme of change. It's not, you set it up, you think about it, and you're done. So you're always adapting, always changing. You know, we all have the upgrades to our computer system, trying to get the new sets, and we're like, oh my gosh, now I got to learn a whole new computer system or whatever the case is, and save my email. Yeah, that's reality. Deal with the soup. One of my mother-in-law says, she's Finnish, and she has a very stoic way of looking at things. Just deal with it. So yeah, okay, you can grumble about it, that's fine. It's going to change. Be ready to change. And that's got to be adaptable and flexible. That is probably, I think, one of the biggest things you can learn from it. And if you understand that, you can be a lot more optimistic about what you're doing and be a lot more successful, I think, in the whole equation. So, yeah. And it's an optimistic way of looking at it, too, I think.
Cool. So I like that. It's definitely be able to be adaptable, be able to evolve. Mm-hmm. So that kind of leads to one of my last things is, what does the future hold for sustainment, in your opinion?
Wow.
I know I'm coming at you with all these heavy hitters.
No, that's a great question. Historians being a prognosticator can be kind of dangerous. I make jokes, you know, in my time. I explain to my daughters, you know, when I was growing up, this is what I had. And they're like, huh, I just can't understand it. The things you see changing, you know, some of the things sound to us like science fiction, but yet you'd be surprised what's going to happen. And some of the things that sound like great science fiction are never going to work. You know, there's lots of this sort of examples of this great technology, everybody thought it would change everything, and just didn't go anywhere. But something you didn't think of, all of a sudden, that's the answer. And they're both advancing. So yeah, I mean, you've got autonomous vehicles, autonomous delivery. Where's that going to take us to? I don't know. You know, how can it be implied? Now, in the other maxim, I say warfare never gets simpler, it only gets more complex. It's never going to get simpler. No matter how many good technologies you have, it only gets more complex. So where will it work? Will you still do the old school manual when you get closest, but you can do aerial farther back, or is it going to be reverse of that? This is what Battle Labs and all these other organizations are trying to figure out, how the best way to do that. Autonomous vehicle, AI, of course, is a big topic. How's that going to come out? I don't know. I think you're still very early in that. How it's going to be used, and people are seeing what can be used, what can't be used. I personally, I'm not a subscriber saying find new technology and put all in. Like, yeah, let's walk into this, you know, and see how we can use it. Just add the tool to your toolbox, because you're going to need one of them. So what's the future hold? Oh my gosh. Incredible things, in my opinion. Answering some difficult questions of transportation you mentioned about before, sustainment. Vehicles, and new systems coming online. It's gonna be fascinating. It's gonna be something where you get to after 20 years, going, wow, look at what all these experienced back here. You know, it sounds odd, you know, when you look, you know, reminisce about it, but it's hard to say exactly what. I can say we're all driving, you know, like Jetsons, you know, vehicles, and now that's going to be dangerous. But it will be different. And of course, when things happen, crisis ensues, things can move pretty quick. So yeah,
no, I just think it's just
flexibility.
I always like to ask questions like that just to see your thoughts, opinions, with you, because you've studied so much, such a historical background, and I think one of the lines you just said that I'm really going to take away from here is that the more we add into it, it's just going to make warfare more complex than simple. All this technology, it's not making it more simple, it's making it more complex.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very true.
Yeah.
And it's not the simple Battlefield 1 Alpha, you know, swords and shields anymore.
Exactly right.
We're not doing a shield wall. It's just the more we've added into it, the more complex everything has gotten. That's why I always look at it as we can never forget our roots and where we came from, and understand this stuff has been done for centuries in a much more simpler means. Let's not forget that.
And I think that, to echo on that, I think that's one of the advantages of the podcast, the Army Sustainment Bulletin and whatnot, because how do you get experience? We just got to think about it. You got to work through it. You know, you got to gain that menu of options in your head. Oh, I heard about this. I heard about the, you know. Just being open to all that. You know, you're not going to go through and learn it once and be done with it. I think that idea, as comforting as it might be, it'd be nice to be all like that. Hey, we passed the bar once, you have to do it again, but this bar is going to come back to you again and again and again. So, yeah, I got to work on that.
So to kind of close out, our final question is, from all your years of experience, what advice do you have for a sustainment community? Just overall. It doesn't have to be not so much the future, but just overall, how can we be better sustainers?
Answer that question, it makes me think about if I had to give advice to myself 20 years ago when I joined the service, granted different service, but being a soldier, being an officer, being a warrant officer, whatever the case may be, is just to be adaptable, open for change, optimistic, resilient. Those are factors that play into it. You have some good days, you're gonna have some bad days. But know that you're part of something that has real meaning and real purpose. And I think even the real worst days, I can give you some ground you can stand on. So yeah, it's very nebulous. I can't tell you, get the master's in engineering. That'd be not bad, but very kind of noble ideas like that. Some days will hurt.
I like that.
But that's the truth you got to go through this.
Mm-hmm. It's just simple like that.
Mm-hmm.
So one here, I'll give you the easiest one all day for you to answer. Easiest question.
What's this?
So if people want to know more or be able to reach out and ask you some more questions or anything like that, where can they find you?
I'd be so glad you asked that. I'm so glad you asked that. Listen, we're two CASCOM historians here. Our job is to connect with you as best way we can. So If you want to reach back to myself or my colleague, Mr. Tim Gilhool, there's only two of us in the Army Global. And so if you get down to the TRADOC or the new AUDS system, I got to figure that one out too, coming here soon. There's only two of us on there. So if you find our name, reach us out, say, hey, I'm so-and-so. I heard you on here, or I'm from this unit. We're looking to do a professional development. We're coming through Virginia, or I got a question about this, or can you send me articles, or where would I send you? I can give you some podcasts, a great military podcast you can look at to kind of keep up on that edge. Reach out to us. We're more than happy to help. We're really good at that. Email is probably the best way because, you know, we're in and out of the office so much with what we do. But look for Gilhool, look for Rubus, and we'd be more than happy to help you out anytime. That's what we like to be able to. Yes.
Good. Well, thank you very much for that, sir. I to the audience, I highly implore you, reach out to these gentlemen. They have great resources available out there to help you to set up, as he mentioned, some leadership, you know, professional development, help you with some the staff ride stuff out there.
Mm-hmm.
They do a great thing. They're always out here taking the captains out in the career course, doing staff rides. So they have a wealth of knowledge. So go out there and tap into it. But this has been a great conversation. Just thank you for this insight. You know, history continues to prove that sustainment is the key to winning battles. To everyone out there, you know, take these lessons that we learned today, apply them, and be so we can more effectively increase our lethality, especially as sustainers. One last thing I do want to mention is be on the lookout for Mr. Rubus's article on the history of sustainment in the summer 2025 edition, the Army Sustainment Professional Bulletin. Just once again, thank you so much, sir.
Thank you very much, Kevin. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Awesome. We're hoping to be able to have you on again, be able to talk more sustainment, more history. But that is all we have today, folks. I hope you all enjoyed our conversations. As always, sustainment leaders start here. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Logstat. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. Please share this episode across your formation and leave us a review. If you have a topic you like here discussed, then please reach out to us at armysustainment@army.mil or directly to me on Global at garrett.h.pyle. Follow us on Facebook, X, and LinkedIn at Army Sustainment. We'll see you next time. Sustainment leaders start here.